Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Welcome back to episode number 118 of Unblocking Crypto. Hal, great to see you again.
Hey, Jason. Good to see you, bud.
So another interesting week. Let's start out talking about the SEC, because that seems to be what we talk about all the time lately.
It's the theme of the last 18 months, yeah.
They issued a Wells notice to Robinhood, which is, I don't know why I should say it's surprising anymore, but they're kind of focused on Robinhood's crypto perspective. And this comes after, I think, years of Robinhood trying to work with the SEC to determine what the regulation stuff is, even though the SEC has not told anybody any regulations. They just said, oh, we think you're violating something and we need to talk.
Yeah, I was looking into this. So Robinhood, they, if I remember this correctly, or if I can kind of repackage it, they were selling crypto through their securities exchange as like a one-stop shop kind of thing. And then the SEC kind of slapped them on the wrist and said, you can't sell non-securities on your securities exchange. So they created Robinhood Crypto for all of the crypto stuff. So it operates as a separate entity from, you know, the stock brokerage that they have. And so it basically the SEC kind of said, hey, you need to do this a different way. They did it a different way. They started selling crypto like Coinbase or other exchanges. And now they're getting a Wells notice. So I think Robinhood actually came out and said, we're just going to push this all the way to court and force the SEC to actually do something here instead of paying a fine, moving on, and then somebody else has to do the same thing next year. So, I mean, honestly, it's kind of a good thing that these companies are going to force the SEC to do it, because I've talked about it a bunch. It seems like when things go to court, common sense prevails and it makes sense. And then you get some clarity and there's some precedents established by the judicial system. And I don't know any other way that we've actually gotten decent regulation in the United States other than through the judicial system. So I'm not a fan of Robinhood and how they handled things with the GameStop fiasco and stopped people from buying or selling or whatever. And I'm not a fan of any of that stuff. But, you know, Bitcoin, it makes enemies and friends kind of blurry, because what's good for them could be good for me. And so if they're going to put up the money to fight the SEC in court and get some sort of a conclusion, then that's good for the industry.
Yeah, I was reading a little bit about some of the top crypto lawyers that were kind of looking at this, and their view is that the SEC is going after crypto more than any other markets out there, equity, bonds, whatever, which is crazy since crypto is less than, 1% of the total assets, but it seems like that's all the SEC is focused on right now. And they were, I think someone even made a comment, it's like the SEC is carpet bombing crypto right now. And there's a couple things that they mentioned. They said if the SEC actually comes out with as many enforcement actions as they have Wells notices, then it's going to be a flagrant violation of both the law and the congressional mandate. So, which is pretty strong words. And then the other thing that what they said is that it's almost like the SEC is just using these Wells notices to get some free discovery and really to terrorize some upstanding U.S. companies. Because it's not like they're going after the little guys. They're going after the big guys that have been around for a while and been trying to follow the rules, which there aren't really any rules, but they've been trying to do what's right based on what the SEC's limited guidance has been so far.
Yeah, and I have two thoughts on this. One, Gary Gensler was on CNBC and they were talking about crypto and how Andrew Sorkin was saying, you guys seem to be doing a lot of focusing on the crypto industry, which is a small percentage, like you said, less than 1%, $100 trillion equities market, it's about the same on the bond side, but most of your focus is over here. He said, well, there's an outsized tendency for corruption and malicious acts on the crypto side. So that's where we're putting some more focus on and da da da. But what I wanted him to say is, well, if you had some regulation in place, maybe you wouldn't see so much nefarious use and investors being taken advantage of and things like that. So, you know, there's a bit of a cat and mouse game there. And on the other side, if you've got if you've got the SEC just going after companies and filing Wells notices and creating all of these, this litigation, going after the big guys, great. Coinbase, Robinhood, they've got money to pay attorneys and things, but you're really creating a regulatory moat, and startups are not going to want to jump into this, right? So the players that are already in the game that have gotten big enough to go up against the SEC, good for them, right? Because they're already making money on transaction fees and running their business. But the next guy who has a good idea, that's an entrepreneur that wants to start up, you're probably shutting him down before he gets started because he's so nervous to jump into this pool because he has no idea what the regulatory environment is and how much the costs are going to be to operate. So it's kind of the typical, it's more of a mature market action, but it's we're not in a mature market. So it's weird.
Well, and it's one of those things where it's not stopping development on crypto. It's just moving to different countries. So we're just kind of falling behind, or the US citizens aren't getting access to any of this. And I mean, shoot, you can look at just airdrops in general. There's been a ton of money airdropped from a lot of these different tokens, but US citizens are not eligible. So there's this huge amount of wealth that's been created that has gone outside of the United States and is not included for anybody down here, which is a little frustrating to be in the US and not have access to some of this stuff too.
Yeah. And I'm all for like getting some law and order established, because there's a lot of people that will just lose money and get scammed and things like that. But there's got to be some kind of balance where you establish some rules and then the players know how to follow those rules. And now it's like, well, even Robinhood said, you know, they told us we could just come in, sign some papers, and then we're all good. We tried to do that and it didn't work. So what are we supposed to do? And so you can't keep the industry guessing like this. And like you said, it's tough to get investments if the regulatory environment isn't clear. And you happen to have a few big players in the game already. And so you're just going to kind of be stuck. I don't know how long this kind of thing is going to take to go to court and get through all of this. The Ripple thing was like 3 years. So I would hope this is faster than that.
It's going to be hard because there's how many other lawsuits kind of lined up in front of that. I mean, you already have Coinbase, Kraken, Consensus, like everybody's in line ahead of them. So, I mean, none of these are quick.
Right.
So yeah, it's a mess right now. You talked earlier about, I guess, some of the details that we're hearing. And one of the things that was kind of interesting is Elizabeth Warren is in the news again, saying that Iran is getting around U.S. economic sanctions by mining Bitcoin and then using that Bitcoin to do things. And what was interesting, I kind of saw that and said, I think she mentioned that Iran had about 7% of the mining hash rate and that they were making $1 billion a year. And I was like, man, that's surprising to me. 7% is a lot. Seems like a lot for Iran. So I did go look and research that a little bit. And the multiple maps that I could find that has all the miners around the world, Iran has 0.12%. So about a 60x difference between what Elizabeth Warren is saying and what's actually going on. And I don't think they're getting $1 billion, but whatever. I mean, if you look at it, the U.S. is close to 40%. China's like 21%, right? So surprisingly, China has a huge amount of mining. And I think there's even some scholars in China that are talking about that they believe that Bitcoin is property in China and not illegal anymore. So it's always interesting that this data is coming from 3 years ago, I think, from Elizabeth Warren. And like we've talked about, is everything is so outdated from government that they are way behind in all this and not keeping up with all the technology innovation that's going on.
Yeah, but Elizabeth Warren can't say that it's 0.12% of the mining hash rate, because then it doesn't scare anybody and it doesn't get anything done. And yeah, if you U.S., there's not that much hash rate available after, once you get outside the United States, because Pakistan, China, like the major players that have cheap energy. And so, yeah, less than 1% for Iran makes sense. And what if Iran was mining gold they sell oil to other countries to evade sanctions by selling to other countries that will buy the oil. So To me, Bitcoin's a commodity. She doesn't get that, right? She only sees it as just a dark web, scary thing that she doesn't understand that people give trade money for. And so if she were to spend 10 to 20 hours of figuring it out, she'd realize there's nothing that they can do to stop it or slow it down. And that it would be the same as stopping them from doing any sort of exporting, right? So to me, it's just further Elizabeth Warren going after crypto stuff. I don't know. I guess she gets Jamie Dimon gives her ideas on what to do and say, and then she gets people to put the things together to say it in a dumb way. But I mean, every time she says something, every time she says a number in a statement, the number is wrong, right?
And not like just a little bit wrong. I mean,
orders of magnitude wrong.
Yeah, we're talking about a 60x order of magnitude wrong. Like that's huge.
Yeah, well, the same with Hamas and funding terrorism through crypto. It was like there was a couple hundred grand in there, and she was saying tens of millions or hundreds of millions. No, it's if she says a number, she's wrong. And she always errs. The error is always on the side of making things scarier when you think about crypto. So I think she's just talking to the 60 plus year old voting base that, I mean, that's the only explanation to be this wrong, this often in the same direction.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, I mean, you have like the Coinbases of the world that they just hired the old Los Angeles mayor from like 05 to, I don't know, 2012, 2013, something like that. And his goal is to be on the advisory board. And he's not actually promoting Coinbase. He is there to help advance economic freedom around the world. So we've talked about Coinbase, not only just focusing on the US anymore and looking at other places, especially Europe, since they seem to be moving faster and everybody understands the regulation over there a lot better than the US. But that's his view is that, hey, even in the U.S. alone, your amount that's unbanked is, I think, somewhere around like 18%. And if you look at blacks and Hispanics, it's up to like 25%. So there's, I mean, you're talking about a quarter of the population, 20% of the population, depending on how you look at it, right, that is unbanked and the current banking system is not working for them. So this is giving them another option and hopefully that'll help. The rest of the world, the numbers I think are much higher than where they are in the U.S. But that's really cool that Coinbase is trying to make the world a better place. Almost at the end of the day.
Yeah. So when we were running the business and we had employees, we had what you would typically think of normal kind of blue collar management level employees that had bank accounts and retirement accounts and things like that. But as you go down the ladder into part time employees, that kind of were just the guys that you just don't run into, that you don't have conversations with. We saw that all the time. I mean, we cut them a check and they go to a check cashing place because they can't cash it at a bank because they don't have a bank account. And our bank isn't in Louisiana or Wisconsin or wherever. So we ended up doing things like Walmart to Walmart cash transfers for a couple hundred bucks that you pay an $8 fee and they can just go into Walmart and get cash, because that's how hard it was to get them US dollars across state lines. And you're talking about the people that we ran into. So, you know, there's that, once you kind of dip into that level of the socio-demographic range where you're kind of in that bottom, probably the second quintile off the bottom, that 20 to 40%. Yeah. It's pretty tough for those guys. And you're talking about trying to get them started, like get them off of zero. Like they have enough skills to make a little bit of money and they have the ambition to do it. But every time they do it, now they got to figure out how they got to spend money to get to a check cashing place, or they got to spend money. They got to get a ride to get somewhere else. Whereas if it's on your phone and you can use your phone to buy stuff, now you, all that friction and all that, you know, I think it's annoying to sit in a bank to get a wire transfer for some of the transactions I have to do. And I waste 45 minutes of my life. Well, for them, it's even worse because they gotta figure out how to get from point A to point B, waste somebody else's time to give them a ride sometimes. And you talk about all of the effort that it takes when, all right, if you could use stable coins or Bitcoin through Lightning, from like go dollars into Bitcoin back into dollars, and then it's on their phone, you know, as long as, you know, we've talked about the Lightning Network using Clover and some other point of sale technologies. If that stuff actually worked, that unbanked section that I'm talking about would be able to work, get paid, and buy stuff without a bank account, without having to go to a check cashing place, or without having to go to a money transfer place, without having to pay those fees. And I mean, it would reduce the friction for them. And it doesn't take much friction to keep you at zero, right? Like it's a little, if you're off zero, then you can kind of handle a little bit of it. But man, if you're struggling to do anything, any sort of headwind, it would really stop you. So I'm all aboard for it. And like you said, that's in the United States where, you know, they don't have a bank account, but they got a smartphone. And you talk about other countries where it's even tougher. So I'm all about it. I think that that's the kind of thing that falls under the radar of number go up. We're going to $250,000 of Bitcoin. I'm going to be rich, right? Like the people that are thinking like that, they typically have never run into people that don't have bank accounts. And so, yeah, for me, I think it's a great use case. And I think it helps kind of bring the bottom up. And, you know, the same thing with Robinhood taking the SEC to court. Like, I'm not a big Robinhood guy, but I kind of like what they're doing. Bottom quintile and the top quintile don't really have much in common, but it's kind of good for both of them. So it's, you know, there's a saying like Bitcoin is for enemies, and not that they're necessarily enemies, but they're completely unrelated, and it's good for both of them. And you don't see that very often in economics.
Speaking of Bitcoin, they've had some kind of exciting news here lately. They just passed over 1 billion transactions, which is kind of a big deal, right? I mean, that's not blocks. I want to say blocks wise, they're at 842,000 or something like that blocks, right? So it is still working its way up there. I think from a comparison perspective, I was looking just because I was kind of interested in Ethereum. I think it's about 20 million blocks, just under 20 million blocks. Solana is 244 million blocks. So, I mean, there's definitely more blocks happening on other blockchains, but there is not the same amount of value on those blockchains as Bitcoin, right? So, and if you look at Ethereum too, they even have their usage on the main chain has become so low that they've gone from being deflationary to inflationary again, right? And they're about 0.5% inflationary, which is, I think, just under what Bitcoin is right now. So will that change? Who knows, right? But I mean, it's interesting when stuff like that happens too.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk about 1 billion transactions on the main chain. You know, the further we go and the more transaction fees are required in order to keep the mining industry going, then, you know, the more I think you'll see batch process transactions by entities that are doing Bitcoin transactions for multiple people, Lightning Network type of stuff, kind of things that reduce the number of transactions on the main chain to scale up transactions for users. And so, yeah, I think, I mean, 1 billion transactions is nothing to sniff, to turn your nose up at. Like that's a big number. So it's good. I think it's a good milestone to hit. And with Bitcoin, you know, another 1 billion transactions, you know, it's probably going to take another 8 or 9 years. I mean, it's not like you can stuff a lot more transactions into blocks. And the first 5-6 years, you know, you had a lot of empty blocks and things like that. So, but yeah, 1 billion's a big number.
Yeah. I mean, considering Bitcoin's at what, like 7 TPS transactions per second, right? I mean, it's 1 billion takes a while yeah. at that point. So I was also listening a little bit to Plan B, and Plan B has a stocked flow model, and it was, I think he does a monthly or quarterly update, whatever it is on that. And which was really intriguing to kind of listen to. And he kind of came out and said, not much has changed. He doesn't see a reason to get alarmed. He thinks everything's going to be still hitting stock to flow. until we at least get to like 50% utilization, and we're 1% utilization right now. So we have definitely a long ways to go. His expectation is for Bitcoin to hit close to 500K in this next 4-year cycle. I mean, it won't be there forever, right? But it'll probably touch that and then come back down. His view is that Bitcoin almost has to go over 100K within this year. And that's mainly to get the miner revenue back up, because their revenue has just been cut in half. So he expects that to happen. And he said, if you look at it, Bitcoin just hit a new all-time high in their 200-day moving average, right? So I think the 200-day moving average is for the first time over $50,000. So that now is probably a pretty good base. If Bitcoin is to go down, then it would probably bounce off that. And that's probably only going to go up from here. Well, it should only go up from here.
Yeah, so I like stock to flow and Plan B stuff. Like it is once a month, like right after the first of the month, he comes out with a new video. They're like 10 or 12 minutes. He stuffs a bunch of stuff in there. It's the same charts every time. He just compares it to previous cycles. It's very consistent. And, you know, I mean, when your belief is that stock to flow is a primary driver for price escalation because of supply and demand pressures, yeah, why not? But his RSI charts are like spot on, right with the halving. And I mean, whenever you're feeling like when the price dropped to 57,000, 58,000, and you're kind of like, oh no, what, like people, I actually heard people talk about like, maybe we've already hit the peak for this cycle, like a week after the halving, you know? And I'm like, okay, well, I'm not on that. I'm not on board with that, but still, you just kind of like, you kind of put the phone down a little bit quicker, and you're not paying as much attention when the price sucks. So now listen to him, and it's like, yep, this is pretty freaking normal to have a little dip here, a little dip there. You know, we're still in a bull market based on RSI and trade volume and things like that. And then, like you said, the 200-day moving average is, it's like a soft floor. Like Bitcoin will drop through it in kind of some of the major dips, but for normal bull market dips and things like that, you really don't break it. You know, COVID broke it in March of 2020. I think in the dip, but you know, between the two peaks of the last cycle, and then after that, when it really plummeted down to 18,000-17,000, you know, it was under that 200-day moving average. But for the most part, it's that's a good, you know, floor to use. And 50,000, when we're at 60, it's a pretty good spot. I mean, I don't think of 60-something thousand dollars as a good entry point. But if you're waiting for 30, you know, you might be waiting for a long time. You know, it might not ever show up.
Well, I think Arthur Hayes, the old CEO of BitMEX, has come out and pretty much said he thinks the floor was in at 56, and we're just in for a long, slow grind up from here. Probably staying between 60 and 70 for quite some time, kind of what we've done in the past with all the halvings. Is 6 months after the halving, then all of a sudden something happens, but it's pretty boring and just chops back and forth in that little realm for 6 months or so. So we'll see what happens for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like we're kind of range bound between the high 50s and low 70s, and we're just kind of bouncing around. And for Bitcoin, that range is fairly tight. You know, it's not like it's a 30% range. So that, to me, it's just let it bounce around and do its thing. And then there'll be some catalyst where something comes up. I did see where whales are accumulating Bitcoin right now to a degree that they haven't ever done before. And that is excluding the ETFs. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, these are just ETF addresses, but they're not. They're, you know, previous whale accounts. And so when whales accumulate, typically that's kind of that's not the peak, right? They usually are selling Bitcoin into the rallies, and then they're not buying at the top.
Well, yeah. I mean, you talk about ETFs. The other big thing that just happened for the first time in 78 days is GBTC had some inflows.
Yes.
Right? I mean, the first time that not having an outflow, which is a huge deal, right? And hopefully we'll see more of that to come.
Yeah, I was looking at that GBTC inflows, and I'm like, man, it's just marketing. It's just those posters at airports or whatever, and people buying. It's got to be, because if you did 5 minutes of evaluation of, well, which Bitcoin ETF should I buy, GBTC would not show up. You would not buy GBTC. I mean, you're paying a percent more in management fees. And it's not like they have the credibility of BlackRock or Fidelity. It's not like they're, you know, highly viewed by the crypto community like Bitwise. They're kind of just in this not great at anything. They were just first. And so, yeah, I did see that. I also saw that, you know, in this Bitcoin price drop, you know, from, I mean, honestly, from the 70s to the high 50s, 95% of ETF holders did not sell their shares of the ETFs. So I think a lot of people were concerned that the ETF guys were going to be in and out, and they're not going to be, you know, not have the diamond hands of the spot Bitcoin holders. But 95% holding and a 20%+ drop, that's not a bad sign for what's to come. And I think the ETF guys, the Bloomberg ETF guys, were saying, yeah, this is exactly what we would expect, right? These are institutional buyers. They allocate a position and they evaluate it every quarter and they recalibrate for what their allocation, what they want it to be. And yeah, they're not going to sell just because the price goes up or down on a day or two.
Well, it's interesting too. I mean, so like talking about ETFs, you almost have to mention MicroStrategy since they're an ETF with an asterisk almost next to them, right? They bought another, what, almost $8 million of Bitcoin in April. So they're 122 Bitcoin or something like that.
Yep.
And then this is that time of the year where they put on their Bitcoin for Corporations conference. So that is, I think, just happened.
On YouTube.
Listened to a little bit of Michael Saylor talk. And I mean, it's always interesting and exciting to kind of see his perspective. They talked about that the institutions are coming, right? I mean, it takes so long for all of these companies to align everybody together to understand what's going to happen and then what their customers are going to think for them doing this and putting money into Bitcoin. So it is not a fast thing for them to do as compared to a small private company that can just say, oh yeah, we're going to do this. The CEO is making the decision, right? This is a much bigger deal. But he laid out a pretty clear path that saying, why would you not do this? Especially almost as like an insurance contract against everything else, right? So what's going on? So exciting to see that too.
Yeah, I am going to go through and listen to those. I like that angle of things because it's like a measured, calculated, professional approach to things. And it's not FOMO into Bitcoin, the dollar's going to collapse, you got to save your purchasing power. It's like, hey, it's a very reasonable thing to do to allocate a certain position into Bitcoin. It's, you know, the same reasons, right? And the dollar inflation's going to eat you alive. You need to, you know, if you're a corporation, you have a going concern. So you're expecting to be in business forever. If that's the case, you can't just sit on dollars, right? So you're going to get torn apart that way. And so I like listening to it because it's not Max Keiser screaming and calling people idiots or Surfer Jim doing the same. And, you know, it's smart guys talking to business guys. You know, it lands better for me. So I do like listening to those things. I'm sure Bitcoin, you know, enthusiasts don't like it as much, but you know, to me, this has to happen, right? If you thought Bitcoin was going to be the reserve currency for the globe, and you thought you were not going to get corporate adoption, or BlackRock wasn't going to get involved, or any of these things, then you're crazy. Like, it's not possible. So, you know, you don't get to pick how the adoption happens. And so, for me, this is the acceleration of adoption, right? Because if you're a public company and you get Bitcoin on your balance sheet, all your shareholders are exposed to Bitcoin. And if your stock price starts to go up, the new FASB rules allow them to show the gains in their quarterly earnings. So if you're like, man, why is this stock going up so much? And you look through it and you're like, man, the profit, you know, operating profit's similar to what it was. And then you see, oh, this asset that we bought has escalated 100%. No wonder we got stock price going up. And then you start looking into it, figuring it out, and now you have individuals into it. Like, you just don't get to pick. And I don't think any adoption is bad adoption. So, you know, as long as you're not a terrorist. But again, I mean, you know, it's a pseudo-anonymous blockchain, so you can only do that for so long before you get stopped. So, yeah, give me some of these presentations. I'll chew through them, and you know, they're all on YouTube. I wish they'd be on podcasts, because YouTube doesn't allow you to play the audio while you're like, your phone has to be on. And if I put it in my pocket, then it, buttons get pushed and stuff like that.
Annoying.
It's super annoying. I wish there was a, I wish YouTube would just come out and say, yeah, you can listen to the audio and turn and lock your phone, because that's how I listen to almost everything I listen to. Otherwise, you know, the battery just dies on my phone because it's on the screen's on. So that's a bit annoying, but I'm going to listen through those. I know Natalie Brunell did the intro. And so it's, you know, I mean, it's all the same heavy hitter Bitcoin people. But now the audience isn't random Bitcoin people that are just going to a Bitcoin conference, right? This is going out to small, medium, and large corporations.
Yeah, it's Fortune 1000 companies that were pretty much invited, right? So it's the bigger companies out there for sure that are looking at this. And what was interesting too that I saw is, I mean, if you looked at what businesses and governments and some of the ETFs owned in the past, it was next to nothing of Bitcoin. Right now, businesses own 3.6% of all Bitcoin. All the funds, the ETF guys, they own 3.9%. And governments are now up to 2.7%. So you're talking about 10% of all the Bitcoin is owned between those three, which is crazy high compared to where we were just a couple of years ago, where that was almost next to nothing other than maybe the US and MicroStrategy.
And especially because those guys are getting in late, so they got to pay a high price per Bitcoin in order to accumulate that percentage of the total supply. So, you know, it's one of the things about adoption. If you get in early, you can accumulate your stack at a cheaper price, and then other people have to pay more because it's more valuable. And honestly, the more, you know, if that 10%'s off the table, and Satoshi's 5%'s off the table, and guys like me and you have 40, 50, whatever percent that's off the table, you know, the available number of Bitcoin keeps getting smaller, and that's the catalyst for price escalation, which, you know, at some point, some people are going to start selling, like people like me and you will sell our Bitcoin at a certain price, but it's not 80 grand.
Yeah, I think the individuals, it was just under 60% of all Bitcoin is owned by individuals. So yeah, that's a lot, but that number will definitely change, and it'll go towards the corporations and governments and things like that moving forward.
Yeah, while we're talking about corporations, Marathon Digital is joining the S&P Small Cap 600, which means it will be getting ETF passive inflows and index inflows. And I think their price was up 18% today. And so this to me is a little preview of what we're going to see when MicroStrategy gets into the S&P 500, where the inflows are way bigger. And Michael Saylor is way more clear on what he's going to do with it as money flows in. You know, Marathon, they might buy mining rigs. They might, you know, they can spread things out where it's not just putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet. But, you know, Bitcoin tends to kind of go into things and shake things up. And if it gets into the stock market, it's going to shake things up. And I'm going to keep an eye on that. I bought some Marathon calls a few weeks ago when the price was down, because I had a little bit of money sitting around. So that's good for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, going back to MicroStrategy real quick, one of the other things that they just announced was their MicroStrategy Orange, which is pretty much the decentralized ID platform. And I mean, the goal of this, of course, is to like combat social media bots and spammers. It could also help with authenticating documents and protecting medical records. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with this. There's kind of a mixed reaction right now, because this is definitely something that's needed. But at the same time, most of the Bitcoin community doesn't want kind of the big brother type of thing all on Bitcoin. They want it to be a little bit more of decentralized and not everything there. So yeah, we'll see what happens with all this and where it goes, but it is something that I think is needed and will be needed. Whether it's on the Bitcoin blockchain or somewhere else is still to be determined, but at some point, instead of the blue check on X, you'll want the orange check from MicroStrategy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Bitcoin is just a pet rock that can't do anything and it doesn't have any use cases. And oh, look at all the things it can do. So yeah, put it on the list of things that Bitcoin can do. And you're going to have the Bitcoin monetary maximalists that hate it, but they don't get to pick.
Speaking of corporations, one of the other ones I wanted to talk about was Block. And we mentioned, I think, last week where they talked about, or maybe that was Stripe enabling their customers to move it to Bitcoin. They have come out, Block has come out and said they plan on buying 10% of Bitcoin with all of their revenues for the rest of the year. And I mean, they own a decent amount. I think they own like 8,000 Bitcoin, which is a little under $500,000, which is a lot, although it's, I don't know what, Grace or MicroStrategy is over 10 billion, right? So a multitude higher than them. But that is kind of just exciting to see that they're continuing to kind of walk the talk and be that Bitcoin guy. Now, that being said, I think they're being investigated as well for non-compliance on something. So, shocker. I don't know if this is the SEC doing that or not, but we'll see what happens there too.
Yeah, no, I think companies making that decision to say, hey, we're going to allocate X percent into Bitcoin to increase our reserves and protect ourselves from inflation and et cetera, because, you know, if you do that with real estate, now you have to have a division to manage the real estate. And if you do it with gold, you have to have a custodian to verify the gold is real and secure it. And, you know, if you put money into anything, if you put it into stocks, you got to pay somebody to do the evaluation analysis and buying and selling and all of that. Bitcoin, it's like, all right, well, we'll just put it into the hardware wallet and multi-sig, or, you know, figure out your custodial situation and knock it out. And then all you do is just keep sending it to that same address every month or every time you're evaluating your revenue and profit. And it's, you know, you're not paying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% to do it. And you don't have to hire a whole bunch of people to manage it. It's you can just add it to the CFO's responsibilities.
Well, one of the other things that was kind of interesting too, that I was reading about, we talked about terrorists and money laundering and all that kind of stuff. So Elliptic Research came out and they talked about a product or a project, I guess, that both MIT and IBM Labs have been working on together that has been utilizing AI to determine if there's any money laundering going on with crypto. And what they did is they worked with a single exchange, I think a couple of years ago, and they tested this out and they found 52 different subgraphs that kind of popped up, because that's how they look at it. It's a subgraph piece of it. And out of those 52, 14 of them were already flagged for money laundering from that exchange. So a pretty high percentage, considering that it's typically one out of every 10,000 of these actually does get flagged. So it's hard to track. So yeah, I mean, we talked about AI being an interesting just theme to happen in the future. And if they can use AI to track money laundering, then Elizabeth Warren is going to have nothing to talk about here pretty soon.
Yeah. I mean, let's figure it out. I'm cool with that. Like, you know, it's all this guesswork of, well, if I'm pro crypto, then there's not very much money laundering and nefarious use case going on. And if I'm anti crypto, it's every single transaction. Like, just tell me what it really is, and then we can make a decision, and you can figure out ways to avoid it and things like that. So, yeah, I'm all for the truth.
And then one of the other things that I saw that is almost just a reminder for everybody to pay attention to when you do crypto transactions. There was a trader that lost about $70 million of crypto by sending it to the wrong address. So double, triple check, quadruple check your addresses when you are making a send, or whitelist the address and send a small amount before you send the rest of it. But that $70 million is a lot. So I think that left him with like $1.6 million in his wallet. But holy cow, that would be not fun if you woke up and realized you sent it to the wrong address.
Yeah. Yeah. I read a little bit about that. And they were trying to say that it was not like a phishing scam, but someone basically, you can, you know, everything's on the blockchain, so you can see what accounts have a lot of transactions and a lot of Bitcoin. And so they sent him a small amount of Bitcoin with a very similar address, and in hopes that he would accidentally send it back to him, and he did. So yeah, you can't. Well, one, I don't do very many transactions, so that would be super strange for me to receive Bitcoin from out of the blue that I didn't notice. But I mean, I guess other people are constantly doing it, and if you're doing a lot of trading or whatever, then you'd be susceptible for this. But yeah, I every time I do a transaction on the blockchain, yeah, it's like I'm basically a nervous wreck for 10 to 30 minutes until that thing comes through, man. I trust it. I know it's going to happen, but it's just things are up in the air until everything's done. You know, it's like the, you know, it's all up to you. It's not like you go to the bank and then the bank does a wire, and if they screw up, they can undo it or whatever. It's just you copy and paste and double checking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, we talked a little bit about last week that CZ was about to get sentenced, and he did officially get sentenced for 4 months, which is a lot different than the 25 years that SBF got. So I guess it pays to somewhat cooperate and say what's going on. Shoot, he paid a lot of money, what, $4 billion in fines and all that kind of stuff too. But what he has announced that what he's going to start working on is the Giggle Academy, and I think we talked about it a few weeks ago. But I have seen some more news on that, and it's literally going to be an education platform that will be free. It will kind of focus on first through 12th graders, and it will be gamified and have no revenue. So it's not that he's doing this to make any money. He just wants to provide some education to people. And I mean, that kind of goes back to traders losing a bunch of money, right? I mean, a lot of this comes back to just education, and even Elizabeth Warren could use some education on this, right? So the more people get educated about this, the more they'll understand, and the better I think we'll all be, right? I think Michael Saylor was even talking about, you're going to spend 80,000 hours working. Go spend 100 and learn about Bitcoin to protect your money, so you don't spend $40,000 or $50,000 and all of a sudden lose all that money because you didn't spend that 100 hours to understand where it's going.
Yeah. And if the more that these kind of Bitcoin curriculums pop out, you know, I'm with Michael Saylor. I think 40 hours is kind of, in order to get a basic understanding of Bitcoin, that's where you need to be. But that's 40 hours of like piecing together YouTube videos and like the right ones, probably 200 hours, because you're going to spend time listening to stuff that's duplicative. You're going to listen to stuff that is over your head because you're not doing it in the right order. You know, but if you go through a curriculum that walks you through money and then Bitcoin and how it works and all of that, the evolution of the dollar and then finally, I mean, Bitcoin is at the very tail end of the story. If you want to learn about Bitcoin, you know, you've probably got 30 hours of learning about the history of money and government stuff. So for me, go for it, put a curriculum together, send it out there, because A, kids are just used to learning. That's kind of the first 20 years of your life, you're just soaking stuff up. You might as well soak up something useful like this instead of like all the state capitals.
Well, in my view, is one of those things that I think learning starts once you graduate college anyways. So if you've stopped learning and you graduate from college, then you're making a huge mistake at this point. So learning should never stop, and you should always be learning. And this is definitely one of those things that I think you and I have spent a lot of time trying to learn, and we still got a long ways to go, in my opinion.
Yeah, I was fortunate though, because I would spend 12, 14 hours driving by myself a lot, which is, you know, not everybody has that dead time where you really can't do much else. Everybody's just busy, right? I mean, you're in an inflationary fiat environment. So you're either trying to make more money, you're trying to figure out what to do with the money, you're trying to spend it and have a good time before it falls apart. You know, so, just, you know, 40 hours outside of work, family, friends, sleep, in working out, eating, all that mandatory stuff. I mean, it might take you months to find that time. And, you know, your 20s, there's not a lot of spare time, man. My 20s, it was like work, fun, sleep, do it again. So, yeah, I think getting it in while, you know, when you, the younger you are, the kind of less you value your time, you know. And so spending 30 minutes or an hour a week, in a year, you're 12 years old and you got a better understanding of Bitcoin than the people in the crowd at the Ohio State commencement speech, that when the speaker mentioned Bitcoin, they booed him. And I'm like, booing? Really? I was like, the only people that boo that would be like Dogecoin enthusiasts or, you know, meme coin people that think Bitcoin's lame and boring. I don't see anybody booing Bitcoin in 2024. Like, you're late. You're going to be really late to the game. I mean, we're in the $60,000 a Bitcoin range, $1 trillion asset class. Booing is weird. That's a weird move. But, you know, you start learning about this stuff when you're 8, 9, 10. You know, by the time you're 18, you've got a good understanding of it. You might even have a good stack going. You know, I would applaud Bitcoin. Exactly. I think my kids would too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was listening to one of the CEOs of an AI company. He was saying in 5, maybe 10 years, AI agents are going to be managing most of our life, including paying our bills, and they're probably going to be doing it with crypto. So it's going to make everybody's life easier and simpler. And if you don't get on board now, it's going to make your life a lot more difficult in the future for sure.
Yeah, I think if you think about AI for more than 20 minutes, as far as if you know, right now we have auto pay and this and that, but if you're using AI as an assistant, you think they're going to pay with US dollars and go through all this clunky nonsense, or are they going to be using crypto or Bitcoin in order to transact the value across the internet?
Yeah. So you mentioned mining a little while ago, and one of the other stories I was reading about was a coal miner that you and I are probably somewhat familiar with, the coal mining industry. Alliance Resource Partners just came out and announced for the past 3 years, they've been using their excess power to mine Bitcoin. And they have now created about $25 million of Bitcoin sitting in their little stash. And they just said, hey, we had power, or we might as well do something with it. And now that we have to talk about it, I guess we have to talk about it type thing. But it's one of those things that, I mean, it's a cool story to hear. There's some of the people that have been talking about Bitcoin going somewhat green and using thermal power and stuff like that are not excited to hear that coal miners were using power. But I mean, you're burning coal no matter what, right? So if they had the excess energy, might as well use it instead of let it go to waste.
Yeah. I mean, after my power industry days, I just did general industrial days, and there's so much steam being blown off because you just have excess steam. You can't use it to spin a turbine. You can't use it for the heating processes in the plant. So you blow it off. Like, man, if you just had a steam generator and send some electrons through some mining rigs, it's not free Bitcoin, but man, it's close. Because once you buy the mining rig and you set up the infrastructure for it, every time you blow steam, you're just putting it through a steam engine. It would be a pretty legit way to make it happen. But, you know, as this thing keeps going and as the mining rewards drop and things like that, that's the kind of stuff that they're going to have to find is, where can I find superheated steam for free? where can I generate free electricity? So yeah, I think we'll see more and more of that. And it's almost necessary. After the halving, I'm always curious to see like what's going to happen to some of these miners, you know, who's got the right setup. And I don't know that they're going to know until the numbers really shake out if they've guessed right or if their strategy is correct. And I mean, even if it's correct, but it's not as correct as their competition, you know, that could be pretty brutal.
Yeah. And I mean, you still have, so the latest solo miner, the first solo miner with this new after the halving just won the reward. So he won about $218,000. He is the 282nd, I think, solo miner to win a reward. Right. But I mean, there's still those little guys out there. They're going to win every once in a while. I think apparently his chances were like 1 in 5,000 or something like that to win. So yeah, I mean, good for him. Glad it happened. Hopefully we'll continue to see more of this small miners and decentralized stuff happening. Even though you're going to still have a bunch of big guys, there's still an opportunity for the small guys to get lucky every once in a while.
Yeah, and I mean, even instead of solo mining, even if you jump into a mining pool and get a fraction of the rewards every time your pool wins a block, I don't see a problem with that. I mean, and I think 1% is a reasonable fee to pay to a mining pool. It's not like they're extorting you for 20%. So to me, there's definitely a way to do it. If you've got cheap, free power, everything else kind of falls into place.
Yeah. And I know you don't pay too much attention to Ethereum, but there is some interesting stuff happening from MetaMask. So their wallet is working on creating what they call smart transfers. And one of the big problems that we're seeing today is other companies kind of are front running a lot of these transactions, and they're making what they call MEV, maximum extractable value on this. And it was a problem with stocks and those trades in the past, where people are trying to put their stuff as close to the actual trading floor as possible. So it's kind of the same thing with blockchain. They're working to fix it, and it will almost create like a virtual mempool that will do this. But what the interesting piece is, I mean, there needs to be some sort of solution to this, because it's probably costing about $400 million a year to customers on this issue, right? So if you can eliminate that $400 million, then it prevents people from leaving, say, Ethereum to go somewhere else where they don't have to pay that extra fee that everybody else, that these miners are kind of extracting away. So exciting to see that that's happening, and they're kind of trying to fix the issues, right? So
yeah, I mean, I guess Ethereum is kind of exciting to follow, because you're constantly making these adjustments, and you know, it's a way more complicated thing than Bitcoin. So you know, I don't know that I think all of these different patches and workarounds and things like that is great. Like, I haven't done a lot of coding, but I've done enough to where it's like the more complicated and add-on code blocks that you put together, the weirder it is when you add something later and things get scrambled and don't work the way you think. But yeah, I mean, I think Ethereum would be better served to simplify the base layer, and then layer two do all the other stuff. But it might just be too late for that.
Yeah. Well, one of the other last things that I had on my end was, we've talked about RWAs, real world assets, and the increase there. So we have just gotten close to about $8 billion of RWAs that are tokenized on the blockchain, which, if you look at it from a year ago, we were, I think, under $3 billion. So we're at 2.5x, a little bit more than that in the past year. And we're kind of just getting started. Like, I mean, you could argue a lot of that is probably stablecoins at this point, and not so much even the real estate and everything else. But the BlackRock Buildle just jumped ahead of Franklin Templeton's tokenized fund. So we're starting to see more traction with tokenized treasuries, I guess. And I think there's still just a lot more to come. And this is, we're just scratching the surface on where that's going to be.
Yeah. I mean, we talked, real world assets has been kind of one of the more talked about use cases and kind of categories for tokens. So I anticipate them making some headway, coming up with some good ideas, doing some stuff. And then if the cycles happen again, we don't hear about it for a few years, and then the next, you know, 2028, it's like, oh, look at all this stuff we built while nobody was talking. It actually works, and it's actually useful. So we'll see. We'll see where it goes. But I mean, Larry Fink's behind it. When he supports stuff, it seems like it's got a better chance of success.
Yeah. Anything else on your end you wanted to add?
I've got check boxes by all the stuff I had.
Perfect. Well, as always, this is a pleasure chatting with you, and we will talk again next week.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jason.
See ya.
If all of these crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers, including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below, and hope to see you there.